Chairman. I think just first of all, introduce who's with me. To my left, to your right, Sarah Burden and Richard Burden, and to your left, my right, is Duncan White. So these submissions are made in support of a submission by Glenn Dean and Sarah Burden to stage two of the QRBC plan. Submission supports the council's notified zoning of the council-owned land at Lake Harwea Holding Park, leased by Glenn Dean Holdings Limited, to community purposes camping ground zoning. The submission also seeks land owned by the submitter, located north of Lake Harwea Holding Park, be rezoned to a similar zoning. It is submitted, the evidence for the submitter demonstrates that the zoning in contrast with the notified rural zoning is the most effective use of submitter's property. It will therefore be the best way of achieving the strategic directions in the plan and the purposes of the resource management act. By way of background, the council made an application to strike out the submission under section 41D of the act on the basis it was not on the plan. The panel or the chairman in a decision on the 2nd of August declined the strikeout. The land, while subject to this submission, is also subject to a submission into stage one of the plan, currently under appeal to the Environment Court. The stage one submission sought the land to zone rural visitor zone. The appeal on the submission has been deferred pending the release of the decisions on stage two. Mr. White, in his evidence, has undertaken a comprehensive section 32 analysis of the zoning sought by the submitter. He has concluded that the rezoning sought would be more effective than the notified rural zone, as it would allow for greater benefits from tourism activities. The allowance of such activities would be in accordance with the higher order objectives and policies of the plan and the purpose of the act, as it would bring economic benefits to the district while not adversely affecting the natural character of the landscape. The submitter supports these conclusions and considers that they should be adopted in the panel's recommendation on the zoning of the submitter's land. The evidence of Mr. and Mrs. Burden explains the history of the land, its use, and the existing resource consents on the land. The evidence of Mrs. Burden in particular demonstrates the benefits of the proposed zoning in terms of the existing demand for camping that will be met by the opportunities resulting from the rezoning of the land. It is submitted the evidence in support of the submission confirms that the land, while being a private lot and separate to the adjacent holiday park lease land, in reality, the two lots are and have been treated as being one part of one operation. It is submitted the zoning of the land should reflect this reality. Ms. Galavisi, for the council in her evidence, considers that the open space zone should apply only to council-owned land. As Mr. White points out as evidence, while this view may be appropriate for some land, it would not be so in this instance due to the particular circumstances of the land in question. As noted, the land is run in conjunction with the Holiday Park land leased with council and has been used for camping for many years. There is no sound resource management reason for including an area of land with a particular zone merely on the basis of who owns the land. If certain land is as suitable as another for a particular purpose, it can and should be zoned the same as that land regardless of ownership. In fact, I'd go further and suggest to you that given the issues the country and in particular this community are faced with in terms of freedom camping, it would seem somewhat bizarre that the council should seek to attempt to protect its own camping facilities and allow for an easing of regulatory control over the same, whilst continuing to oppose or frustrate private operations. In many instances, this would be seen as an abuse of the council's regulatory powers, let alone the Resource Management Act. Further, as noted, Section 32 evaluation report undertaken by the council does not distinguish between council-owned and privately owned campsite. I think you need to closely read the Section 32 analysis to understand that. On the basis of the evidence before the panel, decision to rezone the land is sought by the submitter as appropriate. And we're going to call the following witnesses, just Ms. Burton, Mrs. Burton and Mr. White. Before they answer questions from you and call them, sir, I've had the opportunity to read the legal submissions that were put by the council before you. Appears that the council will have another bite at the cherry as to whether or not the submission is on the plan change. You've made that determination, and yet the council is still challenging it. They have not sought to do so in any other forum, and quite frankly, I'm disappointed for them to make a submission to you that seems to suggest that if you again reconfirm that the submission is on the plat change, which I don't think you've got any basis to say otherwise, having made that original determination, the council will then address our submission. Well, it's too late, because they shouldn't have the ability to address our submission after we have placed the submission before you without us having the opportunity to respond to them. So those are the submissions I wish to make in support of the submission that's been filed by the submissions.
There is a matter that I raise now that probably Mr. White is the best one to answer this, but when we visited the site, the grassed area north, probably clarification, but it seemed to us that the grassed area north of the camping ground, the leased area, was actually not the lot that we're looking at, and that the lot we're looking at is the area on the rocky outcrops and sort of beyond the grassed area.
Yes, that is correct.
The grassed area is contact land.
You'll see most of that grassed area is contact easement, operating easement, and to the north of that there's quite a considerable area of land, about 1.7 hectares. So it is not all that rocky.
No, the rocky outcrop on one side, and then there's a sort of a gently sloping area.
That's correct.
That's got that. I just wanted to confirm that we're all talking about the same piece of land.
Yes, that's correct. Well,
I'll ask Ms. Burton just to speak to her evidence that she's already been filed.
Good afternoon. So back again, stage two. I feel like a bit of a repeater unit here, but we are very passionate about the holiday park and sustainability of the area in the future and the area around the holiday park. I just wanted to quickly run through a few things. One of the things is a holiday park, and it does differ from a basic campground. And just in definition or when looking at some websites, what is that difference? Is that a holiday park is really a luxurious campsite. It's got more facilities of higher quality. It's got more accommodation options, campsites, powered sites, cabins, motel units, self-contained cottages, apartments. Other facilities such as dump stations, cafes, restaurants, shops, laundry facilities. So they're the things that sort of make a holiday park as opposed to a Kiwi campground. So we're actually classified in the holiday park strategy as a holiday park, not as a Kiwi park. So the other thing I'd like you all to think about is the guests and the visitors to our region and what their demands are and what they're looking for. And also just to keep remembering that visitor accommodation or visitor demands in this area is colossal, and it's growing and it's practically exponential at the moment, and we all know that. So we bought the camp 9 years ago, and we bought it in a downturn, so that was when there was not a lot of a demand for the accommodation. And we've noticed a lot of changes or a lot of things about the campground since we've been running it. And one of the big things is that people don't like to pay to camp. And I think that's very obvious in our area with the Freedom Camping. But what they do want to pay for is facilities. And they want to pay for the showers, the laundry, rubbish disposal, Wi-Fi, accommodation, conveniences like coffee, food, shop. They also want to pay for activities, bike hire, fishing rods, all those sorts of things. But they don't actually like to pay to camp. So for us, the camp is a holiday park. It's designated as a motor camp. And that motor camp designation allows for 40% of buildings to go into that area. In all the submissions and everything, it's unanimous that there is room for development and the area can absorb more buildings. without degrading the character. Our lease encourages us to put more accommodation in as the demand for the accommodation also increases. And as we all know, as I just mentioned before, the growth that we're finding in our water park at the moment is exponential. So our goal is to continue to develop the park and provide a variety of accommodation to suit different levels of affordability, which is really important in this area, because we do have people who can only spend money for camping or a cabin, and there's others that want to also holiday with these people that might want to spend a bit more, or they might have families that require extra services, etc. We also find that just in the holiday park, we have a cheaper style accommodation, but people are still demanding bathrooms and wanting extra facilities, especially when during the colder parts of the year when it's when the demand is also increasing. So for us to put more money into the park, it also needs to be sustainable. We can't just rely on camping. People, as I said, people will pay for facilities. Putting in facilities is very expensive, and so therefore, in order to compensate that, putting in extra accommodation and furthering the facilities is really important for sustainability for the future. So we want to make a difference in our lifetime. We've got a lease for 20 years, for another 20 years, and for us, the district plan is all about removing the red tape. And we found that through the process, we have found that for us, the process of that we've had to go through is actually, what have we got here? So the money, the facilities and things and everything, we're actually putting in for our customers. And the money we spend on the camp and the camp infrastructure benefits our customers. It also benefits the ratepayers. If we make money, then there's more money for the ratepayers. And it also benefits the community with employment and also providing accommodation for visitors and friends, etc. There is a lack of accommodation also in the Lake Hawea area, and that really needs to be noted. We've got one hotel and some motel units which are currently actually being used for full-time accommodation. So the wastage of money on the process for us, that's the biggest thing, is the process. So before we can even get the peg in the ground, we've spent a lot of money and we haven't even got a peg in the ground, and it's actually horrendous, the time, the effort and everything in order to put any development into the park. So for something that is a designation, that's designated motor camp, we do not think that jumping through hoops is not on. It is obvious that the camp and the surrounding land, they complement each other and there's room for development. It is not a new practice. The camping ground has been in the area for 46 years. It is the same age as me. It doesn't need to be limited. So tourism is growing. The benefits to the community, benefits to the whole area. There is no reason for rejection. It actually should be encouraged for us to put more development and accommodation in the area. The current process for lessees, being a lessee of the grounds, even though we're under a motor park designation, the resource consent process and the going around in circles and trying to get some development into the area, it's been terrible. It needs to be made easier, and that's the whole thing about this district plan. I mean, it's designated, but it's not easy to put anything in. So the zoning is the only way, really, to remove this red tape and encourage development. And it shouldn't be limited to the council land, as it's about looking at the whole parcel of land and the land around the camping ground as well, and catering for the needs of the guests in the future. All of the things that we've put forward for development, or the things that we encourage or look at doing, we're very eco-orientated. All of the things that we're looking at doing in the holiday park are really positive, and they should be encouraged. It's not a negative change, it's actually adding value and it's actually, we're spending a lot of money in improving it so that visitors can enjoy it. So we're adding value. The open space still requires quite a bit of red tape, but at least means that we can actually probably put more buildings and things in there, being notified and not probably going through such a stressful process. So for us, it's about sustainability, and 20 years goes very quickly for our lease, and we'd like to make a difference and do something now rather than having a slow process. So, yeah, so that's really, for me, So, yeah, it's about the zoning and making it easier so we can actually put more facilities and accommodation in the park.
Awesome.
Yes, just a few. I'd just like to make sure I've got my head. Sorry, I'm supposed to turn this off. Get my head around the area and what we propose. For the area, when we went on to visit the site, we just drove north from the camping ground along a track, and then there was that big grassed area that you've confirmed is partly or mostly contact land, and then there was an area to the on the lake side of that, which is sort of a bit of a rocky knoll, and then the track we continued further on and sort of came out near the side of the lake, again on a bit of a slope with bushes. But it wasn't obvious to us that there was any camping ground development in the way of facilities on Lot 1 at the moment.
That's correct.
Because I think it's Mr. White's evidence, he says the area, that area, Lot 1, has been used for camping ground, as a camping ground for a long time. So how does that work?
No, that's probably not quite correct. It hasn't been used for camping, but it has been used by the campers. So they are allowed access through that area.
So they could go for a walk or go fishing or walk their dogs if they're allowed dogs.
Yes,
they
put their boats in, they spin.
Or on the side of the lake, yes.
We have had people camping through there with vans on the odd occasion when the camp's really busy at Christmas, New Year.
Well, would they be on the contact land?
No,
or on your land?
On that land, yeah. And you would have identified there was a flat area that we've...
Flattened.
And landscaped, and so that has been used on several occasions.
Yes, but not as a but it's not been developed at all as part of the camping.
You've got to remember the camping ground area is 22 hectares, and often, you know, that's a huge area for the camp, but it is used, and the children do use that whole area out there when it's busy, and that is an area that we would like to use in the future.
The big thing about the camping ground is, I suppose what's also quite special about the camping ground is that people do have space. It's not a city campground, so the whole thing about developing and having that whole extended area is so people can have their different spaces and their groups, and that's the pleasurable bit about the camp, is that there is a lot of land there, and that's about utilising it for different types of accommodation and to suit those areas.
So if you got an appropriate zoning over Lot 1 or a resource consent, say, you would want to be developing it, and inverted commas, more than it currently is, and utilising it more than you have in the past as part of the wider campground.
That's correct.
And I presume between your land and the lake, because we would be, the lake's quite low at the moment, there's some crown land or contact easement or something that's not yours.
It's called an operating easement, yes. And right around Lake Harvey there is an operating easement. And it's only crown land in there because of the height, which allows for the lake if under extreme, that it's allowed to go between
abutted to that area.
346 metres, off road between.
Some of the leased land is actually in the lake. Like if you actually got the lease, it actually goes right into the lake, and some of the leased land goes into the holiday park. So, really, when you have a look at it,
Is this up at lot one you're talking about, or not?
No,
no, I'm talking about the open.
Yeah, so lot one looks like it's well up above the operating easement. All right.
The whole thing is about having continuity, and the rugged bit that you might see down that end, that is a fantastic area to put some glamping and set up a glamping, another glamping area down that end. So there's, it doesn't have to be hardcore buildings about development. We're talking about just actually being able to provide other alternative types of accommodation and yeah.
Yes, well, that was going to be my next question. What sort of thing would you do down there?
But it is also about providing some facilities and things like that. And for us at the moment, if we want to put a building or a shelter or anything that a glamping tent, we need a resource consent. And the process, we've been going through that process, and it is harsh and expensive.
So with the with the leased area, which is designated at the moment, with the new proposed zoning over that area as camping ground zone, I'll call it that, it's another name, CPZ, camping ground, that, as I see, allows camping grounds as a permitted activity. And I mean, I know there are some controls over the size of buildings and height of buildings and those sort of things, but you confirmed previously that you support that zoning, and that's a good route from your point of view to easing the regulatory burden on you for camping facilities in the leased area at the moment.
Just it is a bit confusing because originally when we leased the camping ground, we did an outline plan of approval,
yes,
and that was a really good process, and it was practically unnecessary to change the zoning with that process. When they changed from that outline plan of approval, being the lease, we were no longer allowed to use that system, that we had to go through the resource consent system. That, it sort of made the fact that we had a motor park designation irrelevant. It put it back into, from our point of view, going through a resource consent, going through the whole process, it was like the camping ground wasn't even there. It was a bare piece of land, and it's been there for 46 years, and it's not being looked at as if it is a commercial operating.
So I understand from the officer's report that one of the reasons for going to a zoning proposition is the problem you identified, that they've identified that lessees couldn't use the outline plan process.
Yes.
And also that once the zoning is confirmed, the councillors have said in evidence that they are planning to uplift the designation. So it would no longer be a designated site. It would still be a lessee, so that those sort of lessee council ownership control, I guess. But the main control from a land use point of view would be through the zoning, which does seem to be more permissive than rural zone.
It is more permissive than the rural zone, yes. And the resource consent process for something that really sort of is a camping ground that's been operating for that long is still a harsh process to go through.
Yes, and that would be relieved, I think.
I mean, an example is that we applied to put some glamping tents and we want to put some bases down, and we finally got approval, but they wanted us to remove the bases at the end of each camping season. So we're talking about putting a base down as a structure, and so that wanted us, so the planning process has just been a complete nightmare, and then they looked at the landscaping part of it, they only wanted natives. Well, there's more than just natives existing in the campground, if you, as you've probably noticed. And so we finally, after a lot of work, have agreed with the council that it should be a joint process between the council and us, and we enjoyed working with the council staff. But when a landscape planner comes in and says, oh, it's going to be all screened with natives and blocked out and we can't have it, when we already have a right to put a green or pink caravan anywhere in the camp anyway, and then it keeps getting overridden by planners who are on some, I don't know what they get on, but that make it an impossible, near impossible for us to actually work. So the zoning is...
it's the way forward.
It's got to be, because we're actually pulling our hair out. It's a very, very painful process.
It's tricky to put a glamping tent into a holiday park.
And these are nice, these are deluxe ones that we've imported from overseas. We put a lot of effort, there's a lot of cost in going, and we put a lot of thought, and we try to make it eco-friendly. So.
And they're very popular, and everyone loves them.
It's better than us buying.
You've answered my questions. Thank you very much. Well, so that's all my questions. Thank you.
Oh, just following off my colleague's question, we talk about a glamping tent. You're buying rose ignorance. What do they look like? How big are they? What colour?
A glamping tent is it's more like a luxury item, sort of stuff. So, we've got some in the camp that are bell tents, and so they're a tent like that. And a queen bed in them, some lamps, a table and chairs. So they're quite big and they're just a lot more luxurious. The other tents that we want to put in are more American style tents, and they're, Commissioner Nixon, they go like that.
Dome?
Yeah, no, well, they're like this, yeah. And then we also are looking at putting the dome tents into the holiday park as well. So they're really attractive. They're nice looking tents, they're very traditional, old fashioned sort of styled canvas tents that you would have had in the old days really, I suppose, and they're just coming back into
the... That's the material, the basic canvas.
Yeah, white, and they're more of white canvas. A lot of them. Or a tanned canvas. Yeah.
It's a roughly one of the dimensions on mine, roughly.
14 foot by 10 foot.
One of the ones that were 6 meter diameter. The other ones are 5 by, the ones we're looking at the moment are 3.5 by 4, I think.
Enough to get a double bed and your two lamps. And they've even got cell phone chargers and electric blankets for your bed. So, I mean, that's a totally different style of camping, and in the markets, you know, looking for that. And it's
apart from that, and leaving bureaucracy aside for a moment, what are any other structures you'd like to see as well?
Yes.
Well, they need bathrooms.
So it's a vast area. So a long-term vision would be to put in some more accommodation that has bathrooms in it. So you'd be looking at more self-contained, cottagey-type building. And the other thing is also we have lots of groups, so another idea or another vision is to have more single accommodation, but maybe have a group area where people can all have dinner and those sorts of things. We've got so many ideas and so many amazing things that I can tell you, but it all depends on how easy it is to put them in the park and how financially sustainability of them. But we do envisage putting in more accommodation in the winter. At the moment we've got cabin accommodation and people have to get up and go to the loo, and the seats are like icebox. And even in the summer it's cold. So we're also looking at putting recreation room in. So, I mean, we've already got resource consent for some of this development already, but it's just for the future, it's about putting more in and having more facilities, etc. From my point of view, we've got quite a blank canvas, and so there's a lot of opportunity to retain all the camping areas, and because it's a lot of its hill area, we can actually, the buildings and things can be absorbed up in the hills, where it's not so flat for camping.
Laundries, laundry facilities, you know, the campers want, more dump stations for the campers. There's also a maintenance shed, you know, because we've outgrown our little mowers and we now need bigger sheds and workshops and facilities like that. Staff accommodation, as you're aware, staff finding having appropriate accommodation for staff to attract good staff is an important, you know, issue for the area.
And given the issues you've described before, the issues you've had with the council, just developing on that a little further, one of the issues being visibility, in other words, as the council expressed a concern to you, it might be visible from across the lake or it might be visible from the highway. Has that been what some of the has been?
That's been one of the problems because of the outstanding natural landscape feature. So we've talked about, that was one of the things also for the district plan was to remove the ONL. Because we're so close to the township, it's really just the camp is really the periphery of the township. And because it's only a small parcel of land and it's landlocked in between the main road and the lake, you can't put the ONL has to flow through. You can't just have a little jigsaw piece out of it and put it into a different zoning. So the big thing is that being ONL, it's been in the holiday park. We've had a holiday park for, like I said, 46 years. People are very familiar from the township that you can see camper vans, white camper vans sitting on the shore. It is not the main view of the town when you look out at the from Lake Hawea. Most people look straight up towards the lake. They don't turn left and look at a camping ground. But the other big thing about the camping ground is we're really proud of that camping ground. Everybody knows in the area that well, not everybody, but most people know it's been there. It's been there for a long time. And it should be promoted. It's a beautiful place. It's got opportunity to put lots of accommodation in there. When the winter and all the leaves fall off the tree, you can see the buildings from the main road. It doesn't. It's the view that people are after. It's actually the trees are actually blocking quite a bit of the view from the main road. So, as a holiday park and as an area and a district, we should be proud that we've got accommodation facility there. And there's nothing. I don't think there's any reason to hide it. So it's got beautiful trees, and it will continue to have that park-like landscape. But with regards to buildings, you know, if the designation says that you could have 40% buildings on there, I wonder why we're not encouraged to actually be putting more buildings on there, especially seeing we've got all these visitors coming. I don't know where everyone's going to put them, actually.
So the council are basically sort of following the line of what you get, the screen development, planting trees, that kind of thing. Is that what they're doing?
With the resource consent, like I said, it was based on ONL. If someone could see a tent from the lakefront, they wanted me to screen the tents. Now, any camper can put up a tent on the lakefront in the camping ground and they can put their camper vans there. So it is a regular occurrence that there are tents and things right up on the lakefront. And as I said, if you go to Glendu Bay and places like that that are known enough, you can go past on a boat and you can see absolutely everything. The fact that the trees and everything have grown up in the park, I mean, if you came to the park 20 years ago, there wasn't so much coverage because obviously the trees have grown. So I don't think it's the problem of the coverage. It's very obvious, it's very near the township, and it's always been a holiday park. And in the past, you could hardly see it, and we could remove all the trees from the back and you can see every single building. So as far as I'm concerned, I don't think that actually is the issue. The problem is that it is in ONL, it makes it, when planners are looking at it, that's the way that they have to look at it, and that's why, you know, but as a commercial camping ground that has been here for this long, the ONL lines weren't there before it was actually in existence.
Well, thank you for that. It gives you a much clearer understanding of where the issues lie.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. first in the, when I first arrived in the district, I ended up camping at home. I think I told you this story before. I can appreciate having a glamping tent versus the tent I was in. You said the question I have is, one of the things you're talking about is the separation of council versus private buildings. So let's say the perfect world, we move forward, remove that, it all becomes one, the zone gets put over it. Move on to 20 years and we're revisiting what's going to happen. You've moved on, kids aren't interested, they're off in outer space, colonising Mars or something. What happens then?
Who said we're moving on for 20 years?
I'm just putting in a scenario.
Okay, so
if the zone covers private and public land, and then reverts possibly to another ownership.
They're two separate businesses and can, but they can be all part of one zoning. So just because you have a building here and a building over there, and they could still be part of the one business. And so to us, we would be interested to, and we have tried to discuss with the council about extending the lease, but at this stage, that hasn't been resolved. And so we don't believe that should be the limiting factor, because when we originally did this planning process, the commissioner wanted us to include all that land because it doesn't actually have any farming purposes or anything, and so it's actually the most suitable use for that land is in being part of the camping ground. And as the district grows and the area grow, it makes sense to incorporate. And there's, and you've really just talked about lot one, but lot two, which sits around the back of the camping ground, and Sarah and I have written submissions on that, and ideally we would like rural visitor zone. And we're very confused because this stage process, district plan stage process, you know, we're having to wait till the third stage to really understand the zones that we can really get, and yet it's appropriate for us to, you know, mention it because it impacts on all the other stuff that we're trying to plan.
The other thing is also that there's a few things with the council and going through all the strategies over time and what you're saying is like things change and whatever. So initially when we had the holiday park, the idea was that just in the strategies that at the end of the lease it would go back to council or whatever. In the next document strategy, it then suggested that due to the council not actually being, they were the business owners of the area, they were there to have land and lease land, or they weren't there to
operate
businesses. So therefore the whole aim of the council was to lease out the businesses. So they leased out all the camping grounds. Now, a lot of those camping grounds that were run by council, there's a $10 million debt, okay? And that's ratepayers' money, $10 million debt. With our campground in ownership, we own all the buildings and all the services and all the improvements.
Apart from the trees.
So there is a bit of a difference because we have got a big investment already into the holiday park. So you're saying in 20 years what happens if whatever. Well, the only thing is that what would happen is that the council either take over the lease and we stick it out to someone else to lease it, or they offer it back for us to re-lease again. So they're the sort of two things that you can look at.
And the council, go on.
Well, if we develop the camping ground and it does really well and it becomes really sustainable, then the in the best interests of the council, they actually will benefit financially really well from it, plus have a really good asset, in the community.
No doubt that the 1920s council were in the business of building houses. I can't say what council's
called. Sorry, was that?
In the 1920s, council was in the business of building houses. Now, you know,
yeah.
Who who can tell what's going to happen in the future as well.
If the council had actually followed the Act and put in a management plan for the camping ground, it would be a bit clearer of what would be happening in the future.
There's no management plan.
Management plans, that there's a lot of reserves that are waiting on that.
But that gives you your direction for the future. So it's a little bit hard to answer your question.
But that's why appropriate zoning will also help, because then the community are quite clear about if it is open space, recreational, rural visitor zone, and it is, you know, deemed to be under the designations of motor park, then it is. And I mean, the Cotter family were there for 46 years. And
can we focus on lot one? Because as I understand the submission, your submission supports camping in the zone over the designated area. So there's no disagreement on that.
Oh, that's good to know.
We were just focusing on questions and answers on lot one, please.
So with regard to lot one, and the point you made about tents versus camping and campgrounds on the ground, and glamping tents and having a base. Please correct me if I'm wrong, but I'd be interested to know, because my understanding of, if you were camping in the lakefront, the understanding would be you'd be gone the next day, the next week, whereas a glamping tent, you would erect it at the start of the season, and then it would stay up for whatever that period is, whatever the season is. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. Okay, so, yes, that's correct. But also, as of right, you can stick up the tent for a month anyway before you need a building consent.
And then somebody can come along and put up another tent.
Or a car.
So,
I think, unfortunately, in terms of glamping, we have four distinct seasons. So we do have people that are at demand. Camping doesn't just stop in the summer in this district.
No. In Albert Town, they're up 24/7.
Yeah, well, the chair of the community board at Albert Town.
Yeah. So.
It doesn't the same degree as me.
I understand where you're coming from. I think the big thing is for lot one, and I think is the continuing, you know, the land continues on. I don't see why it needs to be, the council land needs to be completely landlocked by private land anyway. So by continuing it on to lot one, it just opens up doors. It is not just the buildings and the camping, it's facilities and things. It means we can put facilities as a right, you know, for in that zoning, out in that area for people to be able to enjoy the whole space.
Thanks very much. No further questions.
Because can I just please add one more thing?
Sure.
Because under Rural General, for us to get any facilities in Rural General and going through that process is really difficult. So for us, if we wanted to even put a beach hut out there so the guests can go and we can put facilities and things, you know, put gear out there or have some other sort of shelter away from the weather or whatever, then, you know, it makes the process under the, makes the process a lot simpler.
And as the world gets busier and busier, people look at places where they can get quiet enjoyment, you know, that privilege where you can actually go and park your campervan in a nice quiet place and have a good rest and wake up with the bellbirds and stuff all around you rather than stepping out like you do at Glendoo where there's 20 other campers piled up. It is actually we get a lot of Europeans that just write rave reviews about how we're in the fact that the bird life, the trees, the park like settings, being able to have that open space is actually worth a lot to us. And so being able to have that extra space is quite an important part of it.
Not everybody needs power as well, but it's also using that facility.
Okay.
summary of the submission. I'm happy to go through that with you, word for word, what you've heard from Mr. Todd and from the submissions themselves. It covers a lot of the same detail. Well, it does have a bit of a planning focus on it, but you've touched on most of that already through the Commission's questions. I'm happy to go through if that's a benefit to you, but I'm equally happy just to answer any questions that you might have.
If I ask you a question that you've covered in here, like a notice, you just tell me. Focusing on lot one, and thank you very much for your plan, because we don't get very many plans, and that was extremely helpful, thank you.
I was going to point that out.
Yes, no, I found it very helpful. So have you been to lot one?
I have, yes.
So, maybe I've picked it up wrongly, what I think you've said, but you say, I think, in several places that it's used as part of the wider camping ground, it's developed as part of the wider camping ground. Or am I overstating that?
I don't think I've said it's developed as part of the campground. I said that's used in conjunction with the campground.
And your understanding is the same as we've heard from Mrs. Burden in terms of the degree to which it's used at the moment?
Yes, yes, and the development on it.
Or lack of development on it.
That's it, yes, more precisely.
Now, in terms of applying the camping ground zone to private land, I presume you've read the evidence of Ms. Edgley and Ms. Galavazzi, and have you by any chance heard the recording of our questioning?
No, I haven't.
Oh, that's all right. But they remain consistent in their view, and we asked them quite about this, that the council's position is that all the open space zones are only really suitable or appropriate for council-owned or administered land, and that if the zones were to be applied to privately owned land, the rules would be different, because the rules anticipate a level of council control through the ownership or administration of the land, in many cases, of the reserves land. How do you respond to that for lot one when, in their view, having a camping ground is a permitted activity where buildings up to 600 square metres in the area and 8 metres in height can be put up as a permitted activity anywhere on lot one under the camping ground zone without the level of council oversight that there would be if it was council owned land? In terms of effects and appropriateness of that rule, how do you respond to that?
That's a very good question, and I suspect we may well cover some of the grounds when I talk to you about the Wanaka Yacht Club.
Yes, exactly.
In relation to the sort of activities that I think are most likely to occur on this particular site.
No, I'm talking about what's permitted here.
I'm about to get to that. You've heard from the Burdens what their intentions for that land are, and those are very low density, more traditional camping type activities with some facilities, which I think are totally appropriate for that area.
Yes, but I'm not asking you that question. I'm asking you, do you think that the range of permitted activities in the camping ground zone, because as my fellow commissioner said, the Burdens could sell it all tomorrow, it'll be someone else's intentions. Everyone has intentions, but I'm asking you about the range of permitted activities and the scale of permitted activities on the site. It's an outstanding natural area. It's got natural character of the margins of the lake. It's visible to a certain extent from the township. How do you respond to the appropriateness of the permitted activities in a zone that's designed on the assumption that there'll be a greater level of council control?
Can I just clarify, sir, for my benefit, as to what this level of council control we're talking about? A is council oversight, council control?
Well, most of that.
Because, sorry, in a situation, we've got a lease, so if the premise, if the land is leased, and all the camping grounds, as I understand it, in the Queensland Legislative Council, are leased to private operators, if there's permitted activity status, the operator can go and do that as right, because they've got a lease to enable them to do
under
that.
The terms, except for whatever might be in the lease.
Yes, but there's nothing, and if you've got a zoning, this, I'm sorry, I'm not trying to answer the question, I'm just trying to seek clarification as to where this council oversight issue is coming from. Because it seems to me what you're saying is that the council leasing land to people that can't then operate it in accordance with the zoning of the land. And this is the whole point. Look at the section 32 analysis.
I think it's got to be fairly commissioned in also including the council's submissions to Mr. White. So it's the council's submissions that
She asked if we understood what this council the council oversight.
Yes.
We don't know where that's coming from.
Well, I mean, to be fair, we're talking to them about all the zones, open space zones, the majority of which are under the reserves end. And so, and they have reserves management plans, etc., which, as you've said, is different in the case of this camping ground, of the camping, maybe all camping grounds.
Is it a reserve under the reserves end?
Not all of the land is a reserve. Some part of it is a reserve.
It is a reserve under the
The council owned land is a reserve. The
private
owned land is not a reserve.
Yeah, so the council owned land is the designation 157, is it? Or 175?
Yeah.
Which is 2.5, almost 3 hectares.
So in theory, there is a level of control under the Reserves Act, which they do exercise in, for many of the reserves.
If there's a management plan.
Well, and under the lease provisions are under that act, aren't they? Licensing or leasing under that act. Yeah. So, I mean, but here we've got a piece of privately owned land going to be zoned for camping ground. We don't have an assessment of effects of the sorts of activities that could go on that piece of land. How do you respond to the appropriateness of the permitted activities on that piece of land?
Okay, to answer that, is it worthwhile going through the permitted activities in the activity table?
Well, I mean, camping grounds is the one I focus on. It's permitted. And that's quite broad.
It is a definition.
Yes.
And we can cover this.
So, are you not familiar with the activities that you're saying would be appropriate in this zone?
I'm not saying at all. I don't have any issue with camping ground type activities occurring on that site.
So, in terms of the buildings that would be associated with, could be associated with 600 square metres, I think, in the area?
Certainly, at the smaller end of the spectrum, that's fine. Once you get into the larger type buildings, which is what I'm hearing the Burdens aren't intended to do, then you do come into some areas of concern, yes, primarily as a result of the visibility of those buildings.
But you can set rules around lot one on the size of the building, so
right.
If it's not our intention to go to 600.
So are you suggesting that a bespoke camping ground zone for your site might be needed?
I might be able to assist in that too. If you look at the other campgrounds in a similar situation, for instance, the Outlet Bay campground at Albert Town, or the Glen
Bay. They privately owned land. Can't imagine.
No, they're public.
Yeah, but it's a combination.
Yeah, that's a combination.
So they're subject to certain constraints.
Now, it's just one. I just have one more question, and it's on a completely different point. In paragraph 2.4 of your evidence, you raised something that I wasn't alluded to. Two further points from the stage one submissions, and it's just going to be my ignorance not knowing about it, relate to the operation of the landscape provisions in the open space zone, I presume, and have been considered at this hearing. Can you just fill us in on what that concern is?
I can. That's the operation of the ONL in relation to based science. So all the landscape classifications.
Yeah, so what is the submission from
the birds? The submission from the birds is at the stage one submission, which saw that the ONL, the landscape provisions, not apply.
Okay, yes. Well, I think that's great. Thank you for using that. Right, that's all for me.
Can we move on? No, I think the question I was going to pursue was what my colleague has already asked.
Should be me to the bunch too.
Yeah, and me. Thank you very much.
Commissioner, I'll say I'm up next as well. I've probably run out of time because you want to run the other submissions first.
There's only one of us. Who's going to have to ask you?
Firstly, my mum couldn't make it to do her submission, unfortunately, so I will read her a bit out. So I'd just like to start with the very little bit that my mum's written up. That's right, so that was Deborah Murray's. So she started with saying, I'm concerned about the impact of the proposed changes to the QLDC plan. I'm concerned about the impact it will have on the tourism industry. We actually need this type of accommodation to address the growing tourist numbers. Airbnb, etc., offer a different type of accommodation which provides the opportunity for tourists to experience local life. These people are often families who travel together. I know that most people with holiday homes in the area would not consider letting their homes for long-term accommodation and enjoy the flexibility that short-term accommodation brings. There are many people who work in the area and rely on short-term accommodation to supplement their income so that they can afford to live in the area. My husband and I are approaching retirement age and are currently planning to build a house on our section of Lake Hawea. We intend to let for short-term accommodation and seasonal accommodation. The income generated will assist us with the costs associated with the build while allowing us to use the house for holidays and breaks. We also intend to build a separate unit for long-term tenants to assist with the housing shortage in the area. We will be unable to proceed with our plans if this change to the district plan goes ahead. I would also like to know what the justification is for applying these new regulations to other areas outside of the inner Queenstown Wanaka areas. Wouldn't it make sense to try and have short-term accommodation where there is less problems with parking noise associated with high-density areas? That's just my mum's short bit that she put together. We're keeping all of that pretty short and sweet for you today. And then I've got mine as well. I've been living in the area for 14 years, and I've worked various jobs in the area, and now I've been a short-term rental manager for about 5 years. I started hosting Airbnb 5 years ago, as I've always enjoyed having people in my home. This hobby has now grown to be my main source of income. I manage 5 properties in Lake Hawea, and I'm passionate about my job, the people I host, and about the area. Hosting has changed my life. I was really struggling to live in the Wanaka Hawea area, as it's very expensive. I live from pay to pay and minimum wage jobs. It was tough, and I've been contemplating moving away. The income that I have earned from short-term accommodation has allowed me to stay living in the area I love. I now live comfortably. I've been able to do things such as recarpet my home, do up my bathroom, and do an overseas trip. I now have a small baby. Short-term rental has allowed me the flexibility to work from home while caring for my child. Without this income, I would need government assistance and possibly be a beneficiary. Through the many years of hosting, I've come to really value the friendships I've made, and I've now learnt that most people that come and stay in all the houses are genuinely good, kind people. Guests have often stayed for many years in order to fulfil their dream of coming to New Zealand. I care about each and every one of my guests. I help them have the best experience possible in this area. I direct them to local restaurants, shops, activities and tourist attractions. I help them plan their journeys. I educate them on road conditions, safety and driving, among many other things. I spend many hours talking with them, and most are eager to be part of a real New Zealand community during their stay. Therefore, I think we need to create diversity and choice for the range of budgets and experiences that our tourists require. Short-term accommodation provides a chance to look at local life close up. I've realised it's often the simple things that guests like about home sharing, like saving their leftovers to feed my chickens, taking a photo of my flowers or even my wood fire. These simple experiences are fascinating and even mind-boggling to our guests. I love hosting and I'm constantly reminded not to take our life here for granted, to realise how lucky we are and how very welcoming and friendly our people are. New Zealand's unique gifts need to be shared. My guests often comment that they did not know a place like this existed in the world. The proposed new short-term accommodation rule will have made a major negative impact on the Queenstown Lakes District and especially on small communities like Lake Hawea. It will not solve the long-term rental problem as it will bring very few houses onto the market. People have holiday homes so they can use them for holidays many times throughout the year. Therefore, they will not be suitable for long-term rental and will sit empty. Isn't it better that they're used to help with tourist accommodation in this growing tourist area? I personally encourage people to rent out underutilised homes for the benefit of the whole economy. I do not encourage people to take long-term houses off the market. I encourage them to use holiday houses to accommodate both domestic and international tourists on nights their houses would otherwise be empty. I know the new rule would be counterproductive to tourism. Tourist numbers are increasing and there needs to be an increasing number of diverse accommodation options for them. Many tourists don't want to stay at hotels anymore. They want to be part of the local environment and therefore rent houses in less busy areas. Ultimately, this rule will reduce the amount of accommodation available for tourists, resulting in tourists bypassing the area, affecting local businesses' jobs and the general appeal of the Queenstown Lakes area. We could even assume that many people will be put off coming to New Zealand altogether, as the Queenstown Wanaka area is a major draw card for people coming to New Zealand. I've talked to many of my guests about the proposed changes to short-term accommodation. Most have said they would be unable to afford to come to such an expensive country if there were not affordable accommodation options such as Airbnb. Now, as a tourist area, we're trying to get and promote more events, especially in the off-season. A limit to the amount of days people can rent their houses also limits the scope and future ambition of these events. There needs to be more statistics of the possible effects of changing the short-term accommodation rules before anything effective can be put into place. How many houses are sitting empty? How many houses will become available for long-term rent? How many tourists will this affect? How many families will suffer because of this new rule? And how do we want to see our area? People living here are well aware that this is a growing tourist location. Surely this district wants to be forward-thinking in an area that embraces change. We want to be a community of innovators where we work together to solve issues and not have heavy-handed approaches where hard-working entrepreneurs are punished. This visitor accommodation rule will have a major negative impact on the area, resulting in a lack of accommodation for tourists for very little gain. There's no question that this will result in job losses for the 700-plus people working in short-term accommodation, as well as a significant negative impact on local businesses counting on the ongoing tourist growth in the area. I am very much speaking on behalf of many people in my situation, yet not just my own. I now have a small successful business and the future looks very promising, provided I can expand. The proposed changes to short-term accommodation would mean that I would be unlikely to be able to grow my business. This is very stressful for myself and many others that I've talked to, and it leaves much uncertainty in mine and my family's future. I'm personally more than willing to help out with any research needed to come up with a viable solution. I'd like to thank you all for your time, and I really, really hope that you'll consider my situation and that of many others, as the change will have a vast impact on many of us. Thank you.
Yes, thank you very much for coming along, Ms. Murray, and it is really helpful to us to hear about a wide range of individual people's situation, because clearly it does affect a lot of people in the district. So thank you for telling us some more about your situation. So just to make sure I understand, so do you host people in your own home as well as on
I do host in my own home, and I understand that part of the proposed plan isn't changing. But I now manage 5 other properties in Lake Harbour as well.
Are they all people's holiday homes as well as being places?
Yes, they're all holiday homes.
They're not homes that you've purchased as an investment just to do short-term renting.
No, they're not.
And so people will use them from time to time throughout the year as their holiday homes, and you'll...
Yeah, they use them a lot as their holiday homes. Yeah.
And at the moment, as I understand it, the operative rules say that a holiday home like that, that's used when the people are there, can be used up to 90 days a year.
Yes.
as a right. So, but beyond that, you need to get a resource consent. So have you or the people who own the houses been through resource consents to allow them to be used for more than 90 days?
We haven't, but I would like to look into that for some of the properties, because I think it would be really helpful to our area. But from what I understand, you're jumping through hoops and it's near on impossible to get. I've talked to a couple of people that are trying, and they have said that it's just an ongoing process, and it's almost like there's just too much to do, and it's just such a big process for people. But I think it would be, if that could be a much simpler process for people to apply for that, I think it would be very beneficial, especially to areas like Lake Harbour where there really is very limited accommodation.
So at the moment, the properties you manage just work within the 90-day limit, and that's that works enough, but maybe
situations
it might be nice to have more.
Absolutely, it would be helpful to be able to have more than that. Yeah, the 90-day rule is all right, but yeah, I think we can do better than that.
So at the moment, the proposed plan is talking about cutting it back to 28 days, mm-hmm. which is quite a lot less, and the council officer has now pulled back from that and suggested 42 mm-hmm. days. You don't clearly say what outcome you think you would like in terms of the process or how long people should be able to rent out their houses before they need to get some sort of consent. Because it could be 365 days, I guess. It might even down to 28, possibly, at the other end. Do you have a view?
I would like it to be a lot more open. I think it should be, you should be able to do it at least 50% of the year, if not more. I think there probably needs to be a little bit more research done on what sort of income some people need to pay their rates and what situation. A lot of people are actually in to be paying their mortgages. a lot more research needs to be done on all of that, and how to make up minds on all of this would be my opinion. I just don't think there's a lot of backing or statistics on this upcoming.
Especially, I'm going to draw this line.
Yeah, exactly. I, un- understand there's a lot of, you know, people want a lot of, they think it's taking a lot of the long-term houses off the market. I don't believe that to be terribly true. I'm not sure about Queenstown. I think it's a different kettle of fish in Wanaka and Lake Hamlets.
Because in your view, most of the short-term rentals in Hawi anyway, perhaps even Wanaka, are still likely to be one of their houses.
Yeah, I do believe that.
So they wouldn't be wanting to rent for 365 days of the year?
No, they wouldn't. No, I think the one of the houses I manage, they use their house about 60 to 70 days per year, just as one example anyway.
Yeah.
And I think that another one of their houses, they come down for a month about four times a year. So I think they want that flexibility, they want to be able to use the houses a lot, but also probably couldn't keep them.
No, the most recent exchange has answered my question. Thank you very much.
In your experience in Hawia, mm-hmm. if you looked at the ridge, are your houses on the lake side or the back side of that ridge?
I've got three houses in between the pub and the shop. In that zone there, and two others, one in Timsfield and one around Nicol.
And the ones in the, just by the way, one in Timsfield, is that as popular as the others? Or?
It is, but it's priced to be more popular, to be. It's priced competitively.
And one other thing, the houses that you, the people that were, they used roughly for a month, four times a year or 60 days, how were they managed prior to you taking over them?
One of them, they managed themselves.
So they were still doing visitor accommodation? And
yes. A couple of them were doing the Book of Bat holiday homes thing and doing the... the self-clean, where people clean it afterwards, however, that doesn't really work that well, and it's better to have someone that's going in and checking, greeting guests, and going over the general safety of the house with them, heaters, you know, what to do in a fire. I think that works a lot better.
Which segues beautifully into the next question I was going to ask, because a lot of the submitters have been talking about a structure to put, so whatever eventuates out of this discussion, that there needs to be a structure that gets put around visitor accommodation for exactly that purpose, to guarantee minimum standards. That would be something that you would support? Or
what do you mean by a structure?
Some sort of guidelines for basic standards. For example, I think it's in New South Wales they have holiday and short-term rental code of conduct.
I think that would be fantastic. Yeah.
Good.
Yeah, I think I know especially Airbnb is very self-regulating, where I'm physically there to greet my guests and make sure that all the safety hazards that have gone over, the, you know, how far away to have everything from heat, how to work heating systems, efficiency of using water, gas, that sort of thing, everything's gone over, and so I think a code of conduct would be fantastic. There's also things like road conditions, which obviously are outside the home, but I think a code of conduct and some rules and regulations about what we need to be telling people about fire safety, like perhaps we should be all doing our proper fire safety plans for each house.
And final question, with regard to my fellow commissioner, have you, in the 5 years of your experience, how often have you, or have you ever, had to say to someone, you're dancing naked on the roof, that's inappropriate, or exclude them from a premises? Has that ever happened?
I've only had to exclude someone once in 5 years, and that was for having probably how many stays.
As a rough percentage of the number of people that you've had come through, you've obviously had one that you've had to see.
This would be over, I must have posted thousands.
Thank you.
Thousands of guests, yeah.
Thank
I
you.
I think I've currently got about 1,300
reviews.
1,300 reviews? Yeah. Yes. And I've got... But that's obviously not everyone writes a review, and I think that sits at about 4.9 out of 5 stars.
You're obviously doing well, I'm doing.
Thank you. Yeah, well, I love it. Doesn't feel like a job.
And the very helpful points you made specifically on the off season,
mm-hmm.
and I can relate to the fact that had it not been for this accommodation, your life circumstances might have been. Thank you for that.
No
further question.
Yes, all my questions were asked. That would be very helpful if the statement you read out could be made available.
Yeah, sure. It's got scribbles all over it.
If you want to.
But otherwise, I can email it to. I'm happy to email it.
Yes, if you want to put it up an email, that would work too.
Yep, is there an email address I can send that to?
I'll email you that, then you've got one.
Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
I'm about to appear for the Royal Yacht Club. I've run certain commissions. I've got Mike Botting with me, who needs to be waiting at 4 o'clock.
Right.
So I'd like to shuffle the order around a wee bit. So okay. I'll do the that's mission first, and then the Royal Yacht Club. Submission on the earthworks chapter primarily focused on concerns that the notified wording of the earthworks standards leaves the absolute avoid in relation to sediment, erosion, dust and deposition of material on roads. Such terminology is overly onerous and not practical to comply with at all times. Those concerns have been recognised in the revised wording of the standards in Section 42A report and rebuttal evidence, and most of the submission also support proposed wording changes to Rule 25.5.19 to put an exemption for retained earthworks up to 0.5 metres in height. I still retain some concerns about the interpretation of this rule. Mr. Botham will comment specifically on those issues. We also support the changes to Rule 25.5.21 in relation to the changes made to the earthworks relating to groundwater. Still, of course, maintain a preference for more comprehensive and specific non-notification provisions than those in the recommended chapter. And at point five, I thought it was interesting to note that there were no submissions for earthmoving contractors or engineering consultants, apart from a submission made by Patterson Pitts, and therefore thought it might be beneficial for the commissioners to question us specifically as a result of practical experience that we've got on designing and managing these sorts of jobs. And so Mr. Bob and I have to answer any questions that you might have on your first chapter, but beforehand, now Mike will run through the concerns of Bob. So firstly, relation to rules 25.5.12 and 14, it's good to see that finally we're going to have some more robust controls around sediment and dust, and I'm not so sure about the one about the precipitation of material on roads, but it's going to be at least allow council to hopefully wield a bigger stick and hopefully really tighten up on some of the practices that have been operating around the district for a few years.
You might want to move the microphone a bit closer to you while you're not.
So I think, congratulations for putting those new controls in place and for the change for it to focus on minimisation. Earthworks is a tricky and most probably the highest risk part of a construction activity. It can go smoothly, everybody will sing your praises about how well you did, but you might not have had any rain during that time. You can get hit quite hard with a lot of rain, and no matter what controls you put in place, they will get overwhelmed. You can't have 100% compliance 100% of the time when it comes to earthworks. And I make reference in the evidence and reports about best industry practice. I did a lot of work up in Auckland, starting 20 years ago, and the regulations up there were a lot stronger and required more earthworks consents. And they focused on if you had all the right controls in place, that even if you had a major rain event, provided you had the cut-off drains, the ponds, that they wouldn't come down and issue you with a infringement, provided you had carried out everything you said you would do. I think council's looking and moving towards creating policies or procedures around site management, which will be good to see that due process. Now moving on to rules, or rule 25.5.19, I've got some concerns around the relationship of cut and fill to boundaries. Now, I'll first deal with the cut in relation to boundary. Now, the whole focus of the rules is to make it easier to trim a batter from close to the boundary down without having to get a resource consent. But I feel that the way that the rule is written and the interpretive diagram that goes with the rule A2 is actually going to create a steeper earthworks barrier, which in some cases could lead to instability in relation to adjoining properties. Now, in the expert evidence of Mr. Sunich, it talks about a factor of 1.5 times the depth of cut. Now, if you apply that rule to a cut of 1 metre, you times it by 1.5, you actually get a grade or slope of 1 vertical to 1.5 horizontal. Now, this is actually twice as steep as what his evidence is implying, where he refers to the 1.5 factor will result in a slope of 1.3. So I think there needs to be some consideration of that further to avoid the situation where you could have cut that's carried out close to the boundary and you can do cuts up to 2.4 metres.
2.4 metres, and it would only, the toe of the cup, the 3.6 of the boundary. Now, some of the materials in Wanaka, I've included some extracts further down from a geotechnical report which has typical slope patterns that they recommend for different types of materials. They start with topsoil and uncontrolled fill, so that's uncertified fill, but not fill that hasn't been compacted properly, of one vertical to one to three horizontal, so one and three. And then down to glacial till, which is actually probably one of the more firmer materials that we have in this area, which you can actually live standing at a ladder of one and two, so a reasonably steep ladder. So that's actually not as steep as what these rules will allow you to do, which is, I've included further down some a table of common gradients and slopes, and you'll see that at a grade of 1 to 1.5 is the second to last one, the second steepest gradient. So I might...
It should be a 1 to 3.
I think it should be a 1 to 3 if you want to be on the safe side. Now, I did look up the Dunedin City Council rules, and they do actually have a similar rule where they have this factor of 1.5 times the height, so exactly the same. So I'm not sure what they're doing in regards to the same issue that could be appearing down there. I think their soils are probably more clay-based as opposed to our soils, which can be more alluvial and can flow more. But all the advice we get from geotech engineers that we work with, they're recommending better slopes between 1 and 2 to 1 and 3 for permanent patches if you want to go to a steeper bed without a retaining wall. Now, so I've included on the last page that extract which has the typical materials. Interesting that table applies to cut materials, so that's where you just leave the cut and leave the in-situ material without touching it. The engineered fill slopes, they recommend up to 1 and 2 grade, so slightly steeper than obviously 1 and 3. So I think the starting point probably should be 1 and 3, and if someone wants to go steeper, obtaining a resource consent to make sure that they've got everything correctly cut would be the prudent way forward. Now, the other rule which I'm a bit concerned about, or actually the same analysis would, I think, should be applied to assessing fill, similar mode. I know that the rule at the moment for the placement of fill is talking about having the starting from the boundary to the toe, where the fill will start, will be the same as the height. So if you're doing a metre, you've got to start a metre off the boundary. But in my opinion, I think you could apply the same slope, 1 and 3, starting with 300 mils off the boundary as you would for cut or fill. And what's the maximum height for? 2 metres. So there is controls around how high you can build up. Now, the last rule, which I have some concerns about, I can see what they're trying to achieve, is the 25.5.19b2 rule relating to retaining walls that have building consent being exempt. Now, this rule will create potential for retaining walls up to 2 metres high to be built close or on the boundary without needing to obtain resource consent. And in that case, it will give the adjoining owner the opportunity to object or be considered an affected party, in my opinion. And retaining walls under 2 metres in height are exempt from being classed as a building in the same manner as fences are. Of course, any retaining wall over 1 needs a building consent, or if it's structurally surcharged, we'll need a building consent. Therefore, I think there needs to be perhaps either deletion of this rule or further amendment. I mean, I just put it in relation to it with my own home. I often do this with a lot of work that we do. You know, what would I like if someone was doing something next door and if someone started building a 2 metre high wall, retaining wall on my boundary? I would be quite concerned. They could do that without having to get resource consent or only rely on building consent, which really only looks at the compliance with the Building Act, not necessarily the district plan, but they obviously do flag there is an aspect of non-compliance. They will approve the wall and potentially work could start without any resource consent being needed. council, and perhaps they have steep ground around Dunedin that necessitated more walls being built closer to boundaries. Typically in Wanaka we don't do a lot of retaining. A lot of the subdivisions are reasonably flat. These ones in the Alpha Bridge don't retain walls. That's more from a landscape point. So I'd just be concerned. I know there's one case up in Minera Bridge that could be an example that you could go up and have a look at. So in the Penrith area, as you drive up, just before you get to Mount Gold Place, there's a property that built a 1 to 1.5 metre retaining wall with a fence on top of it, right on the road boundary, and you drive off your pass and you've got this dominating structure right along the road. So it's worth considering, I think, in my opinion. I don't think we've got anything else you to add to.
Just any questions?
Yeah, any questions? Now, I do have to shoot off at 4:15, so 15 minutes to ask all in the sundry. I hope I don't erosion control or etc.
No, I have to admit, not super prepared for this.
That's all right.
I was thinking you were coming to talk about the yacht club.
That's fine, and I thought I'd put it hopefully succinctly.
You've set it all out.
Yes.
Yeah. So thank you very much for that, and thank you for thinking about the practical consequences of some of these rules. And maybe Mr. White can confirm the matters that are raised in Mr. Potting's submission summary here, are they all in Paterson Pitt's submission?
Yes.
Just part of the extraordinary circumstances of our submissions and the council being tough enough, which is an extraordinary experience. You talked here on the first page about there possibly being an error now, and unless perhaps the talking part of the council themselves talking past each other, I'm just wondering if it seems a bit odd if it's simply a matter of erroneous interpretation.
Yes, perhaps.
Maybe it's a simpler way of sorting this out.
I think when I initially wrote this, I did further read about the Dunedin Council similar rules, and that they had 1.5 times the depth. But where I picked up was in Mr. Summers' evidence, where he, on page 23, paragraph 8.3, where he, I might just pull that out, and it may just be his misinterpretation of the of what the 1.5 times means when you actually convert it to grade. Actually, no, I think it's trench. So, under his 8.3, he's got as detailed in the diagram a distance of 1.5 multiplied by the depth of cut, and then he's got in brackets equivalent to 1 to 3. As appropriate to establish a conservative Bathurst slope angle. Now, as I can show that cut of a metre times 1.5 is definitely not going to be 3. So that's where I'm referencing the error, or perhaps misinterpretation might be.
Well, yes, I guess the reason I'm raising this question is that if it is a simple way of misinterpretation or error, it might be something that Mr. Sooners can comment on, or view the officers could have a look at this very quickly, as if it's just in fact just an error, which would obviously something should be able to fix very simply.
Well, I've just changed to 3 would be the simple.
Given that the BDP needs to be potentially aspirational, do you think that minimise is, in your opinion?
If the word prevent was used, my recommendation to all my clients would have to be to apply to break that rule
on every single
application.
Because we cannot guarantee compliance at all times. And that could be as simple as a truckload of topsoil, for instance, which is quite able to be picked up by ear. Some of that right off the top of the truck. It could be. That is the lowest effect that you could get, but it wouldn't be prevent.
Wouldn't there be another alternative in the middle that you might think would be a practical problem?
The issue there is very much one of practicality.
Yeah, my issue is very much one of turning half a Cleveland Road. There's your unacceptable. In that specific case, I asked an expert, could that have been prevented?
It could have
his
been.
His response in that particular case was, yes, it could.
It could have been reduced. It couldn't have been prevented. It depends if you, well, I mean, you could, you've got to get the, I mean, anything could be prevented in terms of earthworks and runoff, but then you've got to have some practicalities in terms of the economics of actually doing the work. And if we want to have more affordability in terms of the sections, sure, we could carry out earthworks very minute stages, but it would take forever and cost a lot more. And that cost will simply just get passed down to the end user, which that's just the reality of it. So there is a balancing act between how much you open up, work on at one time, versus what controls you have in place, versus what design storm or rain event that you allow for. Now, if we had a 100-year event, I mean, some runoff coming off some of the construction sites would probably be the least of our worries. I mean, the surface flooding everywhere, the Cadrona River would be running, would actually be turning the Clutha a very dark colour brown because it actually flows and creates a lot of silt, background silt. Not using that as a to justify not doing anything. But I think you have to get the balance right between what it costs and what you're trying to achieve at the end, which is affordable sections, but sections that certainly aren't going to cost a lot more to develop. Now, earthworks, I know in their reports they talk about removal of 75% of silt, which is a best industry practice. Can actually achieve a higher level of removal to a certain point, and that depends on the size of the storm. So if you get a 2-year event, you can probably retain all the water back and then treat it, let it settle for 5 days and then decant it so it's clear. If you get a storm that's more than 20 years or 50, really all you're doing is just controlling the water to minimise the erosion as much as you can, and unfortunately you'll just have to let it leave the site. Be dirty water leaving the site. You've done your best, you've done the best industry practice, you've minimised the risk as much as you can, but unfortunately you can't eliminate it 100%. The only way you could is not to do the work in the first place.
There's the point.
Yeah.
Sure.
We could just shop, shut up shop,
well,
and all go sit down by the lake.
I think the question is whether the planning should specify that's in some other guidelines that I've looked at in the past. It says on a 1 in 20, you prevent it, and then beyond that, there's a minimise. Would that be a way of balancing that? I mean, it was clearly a 1 in 500 year you're never going to deal with, but those did happen.
Yes. I know Dunedin certainly had one, was it last year before, and no doubt it created a lot of damage, and not just on existing infrastructure, but on earthwork sites. Now, we've been working with council, and look, I'm not saying that we haven't done things, that some contractors and some developers haven't done things as well as they could. There's always room for improvement on everything that we do. With the recent improvements that we have been working with council, we are, I believe, on sites that we're in charge of, a lot closer to best industry practice. We are working towards retaining the storm for a 1 in 20 year event, and now we're looking at using sediment control ponds that include the use of a flocculant that helps the silt settle down and makes the water clear before we decant the water. That certainly improved the discharge of quite a few sites in town. But there's still, remember that there's always going to be a period where you're taking out the erosion control pond whilst you've got perhaps the site grass, that there will be potential for still part of the site not to be fully protected to the extent that a pond with the capacity to hold back the 20-year event will be. reduce it, but there's practicalities here. You need to get in during a period of weather and completely fill it out. And I know on the Heights subdivision, they're currently filling in one of the ponds there, and are only going to be relying on the lowest pond to provide their erosion control. And there's certainly, perhaps the ability to put a threshold or a...
We focused in your answer there on larger scale sites, but these earthwork provisions also apply to smaller sites. Your ability to control some of those effects.
Your ability to hold back all the water for a 1 or 2 year event probably wouldn't be actually feasible potentially, or could add a large cost to a typical home builder. So you'd have to be perhaps careful as to how that would be applied.
So I'm wondering
how likely is a typical home builder that you actually have settled in the site? even in a large
just about every house site in Wanaka that's currently been built on, have said it, either flying out to the road or flying off into the neighbours. I know during a recent event that we actually retained, this is in Kiramoko, where we retained a large stormwater pond. And during the rain event, we actually didn't have any water leak our site because it was large enough, or the rain event wasn't large enough to complete the full pond. But of the building sites, and there was probably only half a dozen that drained into the particular swale, the water from there was flowing very, very brown colour. And that's just off the building sites. So, really, if you take 100 building sites and they all release a bit of dirt, it always up to a big problem at the end. So it's right the way through. Everybody gets to lift the game.
Were those, acting like a commissioner, I should be here, but are those construction sites or are they earthwork sites?
They are construction sites, but they still have disturbed the ground. They've still cut the building pad in, and so they'll carry out earthworks, but they haven't finished fully stabilising the earthworks around the construction site until they finish the house.
That's becoming a significant activity too.
Some of them will be, some of them will be.
Yeah.
Majority of them will be.
So maybe there is a case there for a standard. Also, if you're looking at that, have a look at that council's land development subdivision code of practice. And I think this council is looking at making some changes to that.
They are looking at bringing in a more detailed site management plan, policy, and guidelines. But there is a disconnect, though, between land development and building development, where the two are separate. Separate approval. So in some cases we have stuff that's approved under the building consent process, they'll just go off and have no conditions and requirements to do any erosion controls. And so that's has a requirement, I say a building that has a land use consent requirement to get earthworks will have a lot of stringent conditions and should have. And there's quite a difference between the two. So I'm not sure how council will be able to align maybe this will be the
are you actually suggesting certain controls on commercial activities? Which,
yes.
No, I'm just loving the discussion.
there should be sediment controls on committed activities. If you have 1,000 committed activities that all release 10 cubes off their site, you've got a lot of silt going into the
room. And it does seem that the 1 in 20 is now becoming a 1 in 3. And if you look at the events, for example, on Alpha Ridge, we had maybe 5-6 events that ended up being classified as heavy rain events by one side and the other side going, wow. But they are becoming more frequent. So that would
be that before, and now there was some, I have to go and find the article about that, and that there's, you can't connect the two. There's the 1 in 20 is just refers to as a probability. There's a 1 in 20 chance of it happening tomorrow. But then it could also happen again the next day.
Agreed.
So that doesn't mean that it's potentially more and more of them happening, because you could have some years where you don't have any. So it's this climate variability. But the thing that is changing, though, is the rainfall intensity that we use is being increased to factor in climate change. So there is recognition of the fact that we potentially can be getting more intensive storms, and so that 1 in 20 would be
recognition?
There, I can't quote you the name of the articles, but I can always find it out for you. But when we use the download the rainfall data from NIWA's HERD site, there is the ability to put in 1 or 2 or 3 degrees of climate change, and it then adjusts the rainfall intensities by factoring them up. They might, I believe, maybe 15% for a 2 degree change. I'd have to, I'd have to check that. So there is when the information that we get from NIWA's site, there is factoring and increased rainfall. So. But as to whether or not we're getting more of them, you've got to be a bit careful because if you get a rain event that lasts, and typically rain events can last anywhere, well, maybe an hour to 24, 72 hours, but around here, you get a front that comes through and it might rain 6 or 12 hours. But you might have in the middle of it, you might have one point where it actually is falling to the intensity of a 1 in 50 area, because it's a big downpour, but then overall it's,
it
might be a 1 in 10. So.
The person that referred to it was the developer.
Oh, right. Well, I can't speak for around.
No, no, no.
Sorry.
I wouldn't expect you to, either.
Thank you very much.
Okay, no questions.
I was going to ask Mr. White some questions,
yeah.
But I'm going to think.
Yes? You're
here. I've got a shirt off. I've got a minute.
So both Mr. Bolling and Mr. White referred to these rules 25.5.12.14, where the officers have made some recommended some amendments to those rules to make them to give them more flexibility, and this is no longer so absolute. In discussing those rules with the officers, and with Mr. Wire, I think, we've commented on the difficulty of interpreting those rules with any certainty and without using a level of discretion. Given that there's standards that will establish whether something is a permitted activity or not, it seemed to me anyway that they're quite discretionary. Their interpretation requires some judgment, and so we've asked him to go away and think about that. But I'd just be interested in your comments on that, and any help you can give us. Because I mean, we all understand why they've been done, and that, you know, that people consider the idea is thought as helpful, but the execution we have some concern about.
Mm.
But and also the solutions are obvious.
Yeah, you're quite right in all of it. Yeah, it's probably more a case of to what standard that they are.
Yeah, how can you find a sentiment to those rules more precisely?
It's specific, measurable, attainable.
Yeah, well, at least a bit of it is now, even if it's not perfect. I mean, to use the word avoid or minimise in a standard is not normally best practice.
Because
but I've got a lot of my time.
And it can't be measured.
No. And so then someone has to exercise some judgment, and yet it's a standard that determines activity status.
Mm-hmm. It also applies that.
Which is one of the issues that we have.
So, I mean, if you have any thoughts about that, you can always go and talk to Mr. Wyatt.
Okay,
because he's supposed to be the best person.
I'll have a look at those.
Given that you perhaps have taken a particular interest in those rules, which is helpful.
Thank you. And that applies to 12 to 14
were the main ones that we had concern about in terms of. I mean, a more precise but very absolute and maybe difficult to adhere to rule was the standard was there before. It's been made more flexible, but in doing so, it becomes super discretionary.
Mm. Of the three, 13 is the one with the least effect, so I'm least concerned about that one. And that
the one about going onto the road?
Yes.
Yeah.
And that's,
yes, it's the other two. It's like dust. Which is always going to be an issue. Someone's going to be out there saying, have they minimised it? Are does it cause nuisance of effects? I mean, that's, they're trying to implement a standard, and similarly, minimising the amount of sediment. They're very important standards.
And for large earthworks jobs, we are spending a lot of time now on site management plans specifically to address dust issues and particularly sediment.
Well, it's not such a big issue in, like, in a subdivision where you're already in a controlled activity, say, or a restricted discretionary or whatever, consent. So then there are specific conditions which could include management plans to be imposed by way of conditions. But these standards apply to permitted activities that aren't going through subdivisions.
These would apply to the building
site
that you're talking about.
Yes.
And you need to be, that's where they need to be precise. And enforceable, that's, I think, what we're asking as to whether you could perhaps assist in how that could be.
Submission, I really only had 2 points to make there. The submission has sought that the zone to be changed from the informal recreation zone to the active sport recreation zone. The questions I had were really, what's the purpose of the zoning? Is it to provide for the current uses of the site, or is it to provide for and avoid possible future uses that aren't suitable on site? If it's to provide for the current use of the site, then the active sport and recreation zone is the most appropriate, because that is exactly what's going on there. That's active sports in the sense that you've got the marina, you've got the car parking, you've got the toilet facilities, you've got the jetty, then you've got the yacht club buildings and the parking associated with it. Then if you're trying to prevent activism occurring in there, then the informal recreation zone is more restrictive than the active sports zone and is the way to go. The other issue I had with it, and this touches on issues that we raised with Glendean, is the primacy of parks planning documents and the ability for council to control activities on its own land. And I would have thought that land ownership gives absolute control over activities that occur. And that's, as you touched on, Commissioner Dawson, that would apply even to permitted activities. Specifically thinking of the comments about building a 400 square metre club room or a 10 metre high grandstand, which, if it was a resident's consent, I'd almost be saying those are fanciful for that particular site.
Are we talking about Glendean or
that's
okay.
Well, it would apply to both, but I was specifically thinking of the yacht club here.
Yep.
And then I had a thought this morning and looked at the reserve management plan.
nuts off the topic, but in 6.3 of that, which is the controls on designated land for recreation, that parcel is a recreation reserve, in the rural zones, which that one was, but has now been changed to one of the open space zones, it currently provides for buildings up to 10 metres in height.
Just in that area?
No, in any of the recreation zones that apply, that are covered by the one code, they can't reserve management plan.
What was the number, sorry?
I'll give you a copy of the reserve management plan.
Could we hear?
But Commissioner Nixon might be familiar with that one as well.
Oh, yes.
There are more questions there for you to consider than assistance for you. But
those are your 2 points.
We did have a look at the site.
You're quite right about the use there. At the moment, it's quiet and this appears to be very, very little light that's during the Christmas New Year period. That car park will be completely occupied for a month, 7 or 9. In relation to what's here at the moment, the only facility I think you particularly need to be worried about that's there at the moment is the yacht club. Club, I think, have some desire to extend the club rooms, and I suspect that they are open and interested in going possibly as high as 2 stories. Certainly nowhere near the 10 metres.
So, you said 0.5 to 8 metres?
I wouldn't at this stage contemplate a guess of this height, but you'd certainly get a 2-story building.
The marina extends quite a long way along the foreshore, and
it does.
So does all the yacht parking the other way.
The easiest way to define it is if you walk past the yacht club before you start to get to the trees, that's the extent of the submission area.
So before you get to any trees, because don't the yachts, the park, sort of go in along behind the first lot of trees?
The other side.
So I'm referring to the
endpoint side.
Yeah, that's what I mean too.
And you'll see in the yacht clubs recently done a bit of reclamation. So the end of the lease at the end of that retained area there.
And is that what the submission relates to?
Yep, and on this end, it's to this side of the marina.
Okay. right almost to Bullet Creek?
Not quite as far as Bullet Creek.
But to the end of where the marina extends to, out in the water?
Or to the landward part of that?
The land opposite the furthest bit of the marina structures.
It's slightly further this way.
Yeah, okay. But quite a wee way along that waterfront.
Right, there is a plan back here, but if it would be beneficial for you,
perhaps that could be given to as far as the chief.
I can reduce the plan that defines that area.
That would be good, yes, because I know you've checked them out in lots, what legal descriptions are difficult to think through. So, the other thing I was wondering about is you, in your evidence in 3.2 and 3.3, paraphrase the difference between these two zones, and I was trying to get my head around what really is the difference, because one talks about, one's called informal and the other's called active, and they're not opposites. So, and so people use informal isn't necessarily passive, it just means not organised. So you can have really, really active, informal recreation. And whereas the other one's called active sport. It's not just called active recreation, it's called active sport recreation. And when you look at it, it tends to talk more about reserves primary venues for organised sports and events, indoor and outdoor organised sports. So I'm wondering how you see those two zones, whether, to me, they seem one's more informal and the other's organised, as opposed to passive and active.
Yeah, and other districts do use the differentiation between passive and active, rather than informal.
Yes, and how do you see these two zones, when you look at the purposes of them, which you've summarised as 3.2?
I think those are dealt with quite well in the zone descriptions in 38.5 for active sports and 38.4 for informal.
Because the other active sports zones tend to be applied, as I understand it, to sports grounds type, where people have playing fields and they're actually quite organised sports. And the other marinas, like the Franklin Marina, I think is an informal recreation zone. And whereas you were saying to us, no, this is an active sports zone, that's more appropriate. But why do you say that? When most of the activity there doesn't seem to be organised sport to me. I mean, I know they might have yacht races there sometimes, but in the middle of the summer it looks to be non-organised. But not passive, but
it's
informal active.
It's certainly active.
Yeah.
You're right in saying that it's not organised sport. But it is a level of built form that is higher than you typically expect for a informal recreation zone. And that relates to both the facilities you see here, the marina, the jetty, the toilets, the club rooms, but also the yachts that are parked there all year round, and also the temporary parking for example, the boat trailers.
More facilities with vehicles, structures, billboard, or what you more commonly call buildings. So the second matter that we discussed with Ms. Edgley was the difference between the provisions for the zones. I think you've said to us now, we're looking at what may not be appropriate on that land in the future. We may well look more to the rules in the informal zone. I guess in terms of the appropriateness, the effects, the costs and benefits, the section 32, for having club rooms as a controlled activity, for example, up to 10 metres in height, 400 square metres in the area, no colour controls, be appropriate in an area that's, I think, an outstanding natural landscape, natural character of the empty water. I'm concerned how that stacks up.
And that's why I raised that point about what are you zoning for here? Are you zoning for use or are you zoning for future activities that are unlikely to occur there anyway? And again, you've got a different level of control here because council owns and administers the land.
Which is the opposite to what we were talking about before.
Yes.
So you're saying rely on the underlying council control. Underlying meaning other reserves at control and ownership and administration.
We rely on the administration, the reserve management plan, and the lease provisions to control things like that.
So, what the council officer says in response to that is more sensible planning to try and get your zoning reasonably close to what the council would or would not allow as the owner of the land. In other words, you don't have your zoning up here and saying these things are permitted, and down over here is actually what would be approved.
That comes back to that point that I raised earlier about what's in your reserve management plan at the moment.
Yes.
Providing for buildings of up to 10 metres.
It already does provide for that.
Mm.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you.
Just one clarification. In the policy, sorry, the standards, about the informal recognition, about the zones, it does say about setbacks of buildings from water bodies, and it's a 10-metre setback, and I'm assuming that that would be the functional location or need an interaction and development of a water body would capture the yacht.
That would possibly suggest it's a location that might be suitable for yacht club type activities, but then you've got the control of that setback still applying.
Other than that, no questions.
No, I have no other questions. Anybody else? No? Thank you, Mr. White. And I will adjourn until 10 a.m.